throughout all of history, they've only talked about the fame, never the hard work, never the elbow grease, never the early call time.
Welcome to Early Call Time, everybody. How's it going?
Pretty good. How are you, JJ?
I'm doing well. We got Nadav and Andrew back there.
Hey, I'm here.
And we also have a very special guest, Jason Aaron, who is the director of Back in Time.
Woo!
Wow.
What's up, guys?
This is our very first Skype interview, so thank you for being on this monumental day.
It was much cheaper than flying to LA for this. So
what's it like in the future?
Cheaper for
three hours
too.
From now.
It's slightly colder.
Oh, nice.
Slightly colder.
Oh, can't wait for that.
For anybody that's out there listening that doesn't know what Back in Time, this documentary that you were putting together, could you tell them about what Back in Time is all about?
Absolutely. I mean, in a nutshell, it's just looking at Back to the Future 30 years after it first premiered in 1985 and looking at the cultural relevance and looking at stories and people who have been affected by it. And at the same time, going back to the cast and crew who made it and just trying to analyze why this movie was, or the trilogy was so great.
That's awesome. And I know a lot of people have said that Back to the Future is by far the best script or the perfect script. Have you touched base on that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. We've probably asked that question to essentially everybody we've interviewed, and it's funny because when we interviewed Robert Zemeckis, I asked him that question, but I phrased it as, is Back to the Future the perfect movie? And he gave a very interesting answer, and you know, he said that it's not a perfect movie. I mean, there are probably things wrong with it, but it is a great screenplay, and it should be studied as such.
Very cool.
How did you come up with the idea to make a documentary about the Back to the Future trilogy?
It's weird because I'd never seen the movie. No, I'm kidding. about 2.5 years ago, I was hired to shoot a private film for a family who was making a bar mitzvah, actually. And
we've done a few of those.
Oh, I'm Jewish.
There you go. Me too.
Oh.
I'll see you at the meeting.
Yeah, right. See you at temple. So I was hired to make this film about, and it's interesting, the father, who his name is David, he hired me, and he had written this script about going back in time with his son to see his grandfather and to see his father and how he grew up and stuff like that, all around the ages of their bar mitzvahs. It was for this kid's bar mitzvah. And as a prop, they rented a DeLorean. A local guy here in Queens had a stock DeLorean. I mean, right off the factory line. It did not look like a Back to the Future time machine. But, you know, it certainly sold the effect for their purposes.
Sure.
And the day we were filming, people were literally stopping their cars in the middle of the street and getting out and taking pictures of this DeLorean. And I was always a huge Back to the Future fan as a kid. Always loved the film. And I was shocked by the reaction that this car was getting. And
sure.
I remember thinking, like, this is a cultural phenomenon that people would literally, you know, and it wasn't like, you know, it was like a poor area. I mean, this is a pretty affluent, you know, neighborhood. And plenty of people are driving around in $100,000 cars and expensive Porsches and whatever. And then this 30-plus-year-old car has people stopping in the streets to get out and take pictures of it. And I said, I should do a documentary about this, you know, just how,
yeah,
how much.
Good idea.
Yeah, like how much, you know, this DeLorean and Back to the Future have affected people. So I kind of put it in the back of my head. And then a good friend of mine, his name is Brett Culp, he did a Kickstarter a little shortly after that for a film called Legends of the Night, which was a film talking about how heroes, you know, can affect people, specifically looking at it through the eyes of Batman. And Brett was kind of in the exact same line of work as me, and I sort of used it as motivation. I said, all right, if he can do it, I can do it. We're going to do this thing.
Okay. Are you a director by day, or is this something that you are doing on the side?
I mean, this, you know, I do film production by day. It's very much a mixed bag. It's not always the same, you know, it's not short, you know, full feature after full feature. I work, I do a lot of my work with a company called Malka Media Group, who's producing Back in Time, and we're New York based, so we have a lot of corporate clients. We travel a lot. I'm in LA a lot. Right. And you know, this is just, you know, this is sort of another project, but obviously it's become a very big another project.
Yeah. By the way, congratulations on raising your money in 3 days.
Thank you so much. It was, I would say that was shocking.
Big ups.
This is your second Kickstarter campaign, correct?
Correct. So just to take you back, when we decided we were going to do this, I went online and started doing a ton of research and just seeing, are there stories out there? You know, is this in my head, or is Back to the Future really a cultural phenomenon? And I found this couple, not a couple, I should say, a father and son duo up in Massachusetts, and they are extremely large, I guess, purveyors of Back to the Future. They have a screen use time machine, the only one that's held in private hands. They have another time machine that they use for appearances. They now own the actual screen use truck that Marty had in Back to the Future Part 2 and 3. So,
wow.
That's awesome.
They have a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, geographically, it was certainly drivable for me. It was about a 4-hour drive. And I said, all right, I think the only way to really know if people want to see this film and if this is going to be a colossal waste of time is to put it on some type of avenue like Kickstarter. Because if people want to see it, then they'll fund it. And then, you know, that's sort of your telltale sign that, all right, this has, you know, this will garner interest.
Right.
So we drove up there and filmed for a day. I went back up just to film like a cruise night that they did where they just took their car out and people looked at it just so I could have some B-roll for the original Kickstarter trailer. And that was it. So we threw it on Kickstarter in late June of 2013. So coming up on 2 years now.
Yeah.
And it got funded. It was a very different thing, though, understandably. First of all, we had, you know, if you look at that trailer, it's still online. Kickstarter never takes projects down, so you could find it. Put a link in there somewhere. And you could see the breadth of that trailer now that I've described it. It's exactly what it is. It was a day's worth of filming, but I think the film showed enough promise in terms of what it could be, and people funded it. But the other thing is, and I know this, you know, I back projects on Kickstarter all the time. We were putting it up there in June of 2013 saying this film will be released in October of 2015. I wouldn't exactly say that qualifies as, you know, instant gratification. So,
right.
You know, we were asking people to get behind something that wasn't going to come out for a very long time. And that created a lot of confidence for this Kickstarter. You know, eventually when we ran out of money and I knew we were going to have to do another Kickstarter, I said, you know, guys, I said to our production team, we raised $46,000 on Kickstarter with nothing. You know, I call it smoke and mirrors, and you know, I think it was a little bit more than that. But essentially, what had we done? We filmed for a day, and we went back on Kickstarter. Now we've done 50 interviews. We've essentially gotten everybody from the cast and crew, you know, who wants to be gotten, and you know, we're going to put a trailer out there. I said we're definitely going to raise this money. I was very confident, but what has happened in the last 4 or 5 days has just been far beyond my wildest imagination.
Did you ever think that you would have so much press? Because you had a Variety article written about the movie. You've had countless amount of people like blogging it. I mean,
just a few hours, we also had a Hollywood Reporter article.
That's amazing.
Nice.
Yeah.
I mean,
you guys are really getting out there.
We're dreaming of having articles like that written about us, and you're doing it right now. That's amazing.
Yeah, and a lot of that, I talk about the press that we've gotten in this, and I compare it really to just the whole concept of how this film has played out, in that it's a huge snowball effect. I mean, what we did for press here is we went back to the people that covered us during the first Kickstarter, and it was certainly not...
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, it was not Variety and the Hollywood Reporter.
Right.
I mean, it was... You know, websites like Slash Film, and these are big, you know, these are big sites, and a lot of the sort of geek and nerd sites, you know, with mm-hmm. that name in their title.
Sure.
you know, just a lot of that stuff. And we said, hey, guys, we're doing it again. And they were more than happy to get behind us and do it. But I think in like the first 2 days, there were 40 articles that I found that I was able to then aggregate and put on our website.
Whoa.
And then that's beyond what I don't even, you know, it just,
yeah.
At day three, I was like, all right, you know, forget it. I can't. We can't even, and my producer, whose name is Lee Leshen, he's been kind of scouring the internet trying to find articles just so we could repost them, but
sure.
It's, and it's probably your dream come true to have the early call time podcast reach out to you. I mean, that's like
that's what I said on first day. I got the call and I was like, guys, we made it.
Well, I
the
I
campaign is still open, right?
It is.
It's we're only 5 days in. It's crazy.
We have a 30-day campaign.
Of a 30-day campaign, we did 30 this time, and we can certainly get into just Kickstarter stuff later, you know, and things that we've learned from it. But the first time we had done 45 days, and my thinking with absolutely zero experience or professional advice was, well, we should do it longer because nobody knows who we are. So we're going to need this time for our project to simmer and let people find out about it. And that was just wrong. I mean, you know, Kickstarter, when you do a project, they recommend that you do 30 days. You have the ability to go from 30 to 60, but they recommend 30 because it gives people this sense of like, all right, I got to do it now. Not, oh, I have 42 days to do it.
Right.
So we went live on Monday. I guess that was the 8th or 9th of March. I have lost track of all time.
2015.
Yeah. 2015. If I'm wrong, we'll get in the time machine and...
There we go. And we're recording on Saturday, obviously. This is going to go up on Tuesday. So let's see. Math.
The campaign will still be open.
7, 8. It'll be day 8. Eight or
one
nine.
Thing I could say, because I'm looking at the Kickstarter right now, is it goes till April 8th. So, yeah. So that means that we started on March 8th. Makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Right. Checks out.
Do you watch it like Walt Jr. watched the counter on Breaking Bad when people were donating money to Walter White, and just every time money comes in, it just dings and you dance?
Another donation, yeah. Dad.
What's really, you know, it's funny that you say that. What's really cool about Kickstarter, first of all, the website does auto-update. So as it comes in, like, you see the numbers changing.
Right.
But, you know, in literally 5 days, we have close to 1,200 backers.
That's incredible.
What type of prizes are they getting?
Oh, some really cool stuff. The, you know, the basics, your DVDs, Blu-rays, digital copies of the film. Then once you get into other stuff, we have T-shirts, posters, signed Back in Time license plates.
Ooh.
And then we have a bunch of stuff that was signed by people involved with the film. So Bob Gale signed some stuff for us, Robert Zemeckis, Michael J. Fox, although that's gone.
not surprisingly.
And, yeah. That actually went in the first 5 minutes.
Wow, that's incredible.
Alan Silvestri signed sheet music, the Back to the Future sheet music. James Tolkien signed some stuff for us, and then we were filming at a Comic-Con. We were filming another principals for the documentary. Their names are Terry and Oliver Holler. And while we were there, I was just walking in you know, Artist Alley, and I was so impressed by a lot of the work. And we spoke with two different artists, and one of them, his name is Andrew Heath, and he had done a Back to the Future print, but he made it a limited edition Back in Time thing where he changed the out-of-time Back to the Future license plate to Back in Time. So he signed 100 of those prints for us, and just so a lot of really cool stuff. The other thing, one of our co-producers on this documentary is Adam F. Goldberg, who is the creator of ABC's The Goldbergs. And coming Monday, so it'll be yesterday for anyone listening to this, or at a day, depending on when you listen, we're actually going to be auctioning off some of his own stuff. So that's going to be really cool. Obviously, the Goldbergs is set in the 80s, you know, around Back to the Future time.
That makes
so
sense.
Yeah, so he's actually throwing in some of his own personal stuff for the campaign and some interesting opportunities to, you know, have a meal with him or go to the set of the Goldbergs, like really cool, you know, opportunities that aren't necessarily directly Back to the Future related, but just cool.
The 80s related.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
I was going to ask you because on the site it says that you guys are going to be putting out more and different prizes and things like that. So I was going to see if you would give us a sneak peek on that, but you already kind of did. So.
Yeah. I mean, it won't be a secret by the time this comes out, so I could certainly tell you guys, but that's kind of what we're looking at. The other thing is one of the biggest requests that we've gotten, and this just speaks to Back to the Future's global reach, is what languages we're going to translate this into for subtitles.
Whoa.
So
did you guys even start thinking about that before that question was asked?
We had gotten a lot of like Spanish and French for the original Kickstarter, and somewhere in the middle of it, we added the film in Spanish as a reward, because that was kind of the most obvious one.
As a reward?
Yeah. So
like, donate $20,000
in Spanish. No, it was literally like an extra $2 to get the digital version with Spanish subtitles.
Oh, okay.
That was it, you know? But part of the reason why we did that wasn't really for the $2. It was more to kind of gauge, and this time it's $3 more for this campaign, but we wanted to gauge how many people wanted it. So it was like a very good way to track it, you know?
Oh, that's clever.
And like now we only have 4 backers specifically for Spanish, but we did announce that, you know, if you buy a DVD or Blu-ray, you'll have the subtitles on there. So that's really, it's only for the people who are just getting the digital copy that have to worry about the, you know, for the Spanish subtitles. But for this campaign, we've gotten Spanish, French, Italian. The craziest one that I would have never imagined is English.
And for a hard of hearing?
I think the reason is that there are people, I guess, overseas, and a lot of them have been from, like, Asian countries, where they speak English, but they don't speak it well enough to keep up with an American dialect. So if they could read the words, I think it helps them understand.
Like a Hooked on Phonics type of deal.
Something like that. So I said, well, I mean, I could translate it into English. I certainly speak, I speak some good English, you know?
The majority of our listeners are Yiddish, so I don't know if that's a perfect possibility.
It's Givaldic.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
for Shanum.
Yeah. So I, you know, that is we're actually going to release that as a stretch goal. So by the time your listeners are listening to this, that will be the $88,000 stretch goal for,
of course,
with the 88 mile per hour reference.
Ah, clever.
Yes, yes. Nailed Beyond us. That, I don't know. Yeah. It's the kind of thing where we put the Kickstarter out for $50,000, and you know, for those who don't know how Kickstarter works, if you don't get 50, if you get 49,999, you get nothing. So there's always a concern of how, you know, what do you set the threshold at? I mean, the obvious answer is you put what you need, but, you know, there was no way that we were not making this film. I mean, even if we got $0 for this Kickstarter, we were going to have to just go through traditional avenues of funding to finish it. I wasn't worried about it, like I said, but it wasn't a concern. We need more than $50,000 to finish this film. I was sort of looking at 60 as a magic number, but I think the one thing that I've learned through this project that, you know, anyone listening to this who wants to make a film or who has made a film can relate with is that whatever you think it's going to cost, it's going to cost a lot more. So even saying 60,000 and having that number comfortably in my head a week ago, I know is meaningless because things are going to come up. So
sure.
Another question that we've gotten once we, you know, eclipsed the $50,000 mark was, well, you guys raised your goal. What are you going to do with the extra money? So after we get back from Hawaii, I said, well, with the extra money, we could just make the film better. I don't have to go to every single person who's going to be working on the post-production of this film and beg them to give me a discount, which is what I've done already.
Right.
And I'm sure they're following the Kickstarter too. So it gives you that ability to open up a little bit more. Or when I go to a sound mixer to say, I don't have to go to some guy on Craigslist that I've never heard of. You know, I can go to a recommendation from somebody in the business who's done this, who's worked on features before, who just has a better feel for it. The truth is color, music, and editing, we knew who we were going to use before we did this Kickstarter. But money was a concern. The track that you hear in the trailer, the acoustic version of Back to the Future, was done by an artist by the name of Gregory Johnson, who's online on YouTube. His YouTube name is Acoustic Labs, and he's a working musician. He put that song out a year ago, about, it might be less. And it was, the minute I heard it, and I didn't even have to listen twice, I said, this is the guy that's going to compose the original music for our film.
Awesome. I'm sure he was stoked.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the time we had been done, our Kickstarter was done already, our first one. We were in the middle of production, and I sent him an email and I said, you just get how to translate Back to the Future into an emotion that we're trying to capture for our film. We have to meet. So the next time we were in California, I met him in Marina Del Rey. We went to breakfast and, you know, we vibed. It was exactly what I thought it was going to be. And I said, all right, you're the guy who's going to compose our film. Now, we started talking money at the time, and what he wanted I knew was fair, but I also knew that with our original Kickstarter budget, there was no way we could afford it. So already back then, and this is shortly after our Kickstarter, I kind of had in the back of my head that we're going to have to get more money some way, somehow, along the way. We weren't quite at the point yet where I said, okay, we're broke. Right. We need another Kickstarter. But it was always something lingering throughout production.
So, like, what other, like, obstacles have you come across, like, in trying to make this documentary?
I think the biggest thing is if you're planning a Back to the Future documentary and you're sitting in that pre-production meeting, you go, okay, well, who do we want in this? So we want Michael J. Fox, Christopher Lloyd, Robert Zemeckis, Bob Gale, Tom Wilson, Crispin Glover, and you just start naming everyone that was in Back to the Future.
Right.
And then you go, oh, wait, nobody knows who we are. This is never going to happen. So that was just the obvious hurdle that we were going to face. Now, the big thing was that Bob Gale was behind this. Bob Gale, of course, is the writer and producer of the trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
He was behind us before we went on Kickstarter the first time. We reached out to him.
That's great.
We got his contact. And he's, he has been the gatekeeper of Back to the Future on every level since the film came out. Always has been, always is. Everything kind of runs across his desk if it has anything to do with Back to the Future. And it's a beautiful thing, and he does a great job doing that. So we knew we had him behind us, and we knew that he would be featured in our documentary.
Killer.
Yeah, and once we met him, he said, listen, if you need help getting anybody, let me know. But, it's not so simple, and even being who he is, he can't just call Michael J. Fox and say, so Tuesday morning I got these three guys coming in. Cool,
Right.
It just doesn't work that way.
Well, it's good that you have the writer behind it. I mean, him and Robert Zemeckis, they wrote it together, correct?
Well, correct, yeah.
Was it easy to get them? Was it easy to get them on board? Like, was it like, hey, so we're doing this documentary? He's like, say no more, I'm in. Or was it like a little bit more convincing and finagling?
I think with Bob, we just kind of pitched him the idea over email, and he got it. And it was sort of, I don't know what his thought process was, but in terms of a communication path, it was very easy. It was like, email, I like it, go ahead, let's do it.
Nice.
So that part was easy. It's everybody else that was very difficult.
Did you have to reach out to casting directors or agents?
Everybody was different. In terms of getting Christopher Lloyd, and this is a really fun story, Bob Gale spoke to him on behalf of us, and then once he agreed to do it, Bob Gale sends me an email and he said, here's Christopher Lloyd's cell phone number. Go ahead and give him a call. And it goes without saying, but don't give it out.
Sure.
So then there I am. I'm, calling Christopher Lloyd on my, on his cell phone. Hey, so I know you spoke to Bob. When would you like to sit down? And it was very funny. And it was kind of weird. And he had called me back like the week going back, and I have an iPhone, and I'm very anal about putting everybody's pictures into the, so that when they call, you see their picture. So sure. I just have a big picture of like Doc Brown, as he's calling. And I'm like, wow. Hello. And it was very funny. And he called me back. He goes, hi, this is Chris. I'm like, yeah, I know who it is.
I can't say his name without saying it. His full name. I can't say Christopher. I just can't say Christopher. It has to be Christopher Lloyd. Did you have that
his
kind of...
His friends call him Chris.
Yeah, but I mean, did you have that kind of almost mentality about like meeting some of these people? Like, hey, it's Leah Thompson. How you doing?
It's like, good morning, Michael J. Fox.
Yeah. It is. It's kind of... one of the things that's really cool about Back to the Future is that everybody associated with the documentary is very... down to earth. They're like just regular, they're sort of like regular people. When you see Chris, oh, hi, my name's Chris. It's not like, please address me as Christopher Lloyd or Mr. Lloyd, if you'd prefer, and Michael J. Fox was the same way. It's, hey, I'm Michael.
Crispin Glover was down to earth too.
Crispin Glover, I'm not sure if he's on earth because,
we all saw that Letterman interview.
Yeah. The only two people that were just completely abstained from doing this documentary, and it's not us, it's really anything Back to the Future related, is Crispin Glover, like you said, and Tom Wilson, who played Biff. They don't really do Back to the Future anymore. Tom Wilson doesn't even want to know about it.
That's so funny.
Huh. He just doesn't do Back to the Future.
But he does that great song and a stand-up bit.
Yeah.
About working on Back to the Future.
I saw him do a bit where he's performing a song, and it's titled Please Don't Ask Me That.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's just all the questions that people ask him about Back to the Future. Like, how was it working with Michael J. Fox? Don't ask me that.
Yeah. And was it real manure?
Yes.
No. Yeah.
Don't ask me that.
It's not.
I believe the answer to that line is, it's a movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
So he, I mean, he just doesn't want to do it. And Crispin, I saw him in an interview on a, I'm trying to remember if it was like Opie and Anthony or Howard Stern or something of that ilk. And he will talk to you about Back to the Future, but he will talk to you about how much he does not like Back to the Future.
Well, there was this big lawsuit or something about Back to the Future 2 and
yes,
his image used and things like that. So
Jeffrey Weissman, who we interviewed for our documentary, played George McFly in Back to the Futures Part 2 and 3. There were essentially some contract issues, and Crispin was not put back on the movie. And they needed somebody to play George. Obviously, the role itself was significantly reduced. So they hired Jeffrey Weissman. And this became a landmark case for this because essentially, not only did they use Jeffrey Weissman to made up, you know, and make up to look like Crispin Glover, but what happened is they used some scenes with Crispin Glover in it. They just took footage from Back to the Future Part 1 and inserted it, you know, more for the close-up stuff where it would be, you know, just very obvious.
Right.
And Crispin sued, and he won money, and it became a thing that you cannot do that. You know, if you want to reuse somebody in a different movie, you have to pay them.
Right. Well, and I always wondered why George McFly was upside down in half the movie in Back to the Future 2. And,
yeah.
And then after I realized that that wasn't Crispin Glover, I was like, oh, that makes complete sense.
Yeah, that was Jeffrey Weissman. That was his main, you know, speaking scene in Back to the Future Part 2. I never asked them that. Why, you know, did you put him upside down so nobody would recognize him? But of course, the big thing is that George McFly in that scene is like 80. So,
yeah,
you know, right. They have him in old man prosthetics, and, you know, Crispin Glover wouldn't have looked like Crispin Glover. And of course, Michael J. Fox plays three characters in that scene, and one of them is a girl. So they can get away with anything.
Did you talk to the director of photography?
Yes. His name is Dean Cundey.
Did he talk about that scene in the dinner scene and how they used like computers to run the cameras and things like that?
Yeah, so we talked to him about it and Robert Zemeckis, and I mean it was well ahead of its time. They were using what they did is they used motion control cameras to run the scene on different passes, and then they had to splice the film, you know, along the break lines and put it together. And there's a really cool story from that scene, which is that there was an earthquake in the middle of them filming that scene, not while they were filming, but overnight. So the problem was that all the set pieces had been nailed down so that they wouldn't move, so that when they cut the film, things wouldn't look like they were, you know, erased in space. And then they had an earthquake. So they were unsure whether or not anything moved. They didn't know. So what they decided to do is finish filming the scene and then put it together and see if it worked. And luckily it worked. But they were, you know, Robert Zemeckis said that they were fully prepared to have to reshoot that entire thing because of that.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
That would be a horror story.
Yes. To say the least. Don't have earthquakes on your set.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you try to sign up for them, but the Earthquake Union, they're very strict in L.A. So.
Yeah, they are. They got a lot of work out here.
Were you guys able to interview, I think that it happened in number 3, but there was like a little kid that like signals the camera to come a little closer, and then he points to his dick, I think.
Yes. Yes. I think he's still a working actor. We didn't interview him. He was one of Doc Brown's kids, and the rumor mill says that he had to go to the bathroom or something. And it made the final cut.
Yeah, it did.
Oh, as well it should have.
It's kind of creepy.
I'm surprised he didn't get a talking to of like, you'll never work in this town again. But if he's a working actor, then he figured it out.
I believe one of the two kids still works and one doesn't. I'm not sure which is which.
I think the dick pointer is not the one who's working.
Yeah. Well, actually,
he's working in Chatsworth.
I was about to say he got into porn after that.
Yeah. So what exactly, I mean, what are you hoping that the film looks like at the end in terms of kind of the narrative, for lack of a better word? I mean, is it interviews and then footage from the movie, or what's kind of the...
There will definitely be a chunk. I mean, there will definitely be a chunk of footage in the movie to support what, you know, people are talking about. And I think if you're looking at it as a, you know, if you're trying to classify it as far as a documentary, it's going to be very interview heavy. Mm-hmm. We didn't shoot eons and eons of B-roll. I mean, we shot B-roll to cover the stories that we're talking about, but, you know, beyond that, it's going to be a lot of talking. So it will not be very good as a silent film.
But it's stories from shooting the movie and tidbits about it and things like that? Is that?
Yeah, I mean, because there's a really, you know, like I said, we interviewed 50 people, and it's a really good mix of cast and crew and then fans. So from the cast and crew, we asked them about, you know, oh, what was your favorite scene to shoot and stuff like that. But we still wanted them, because again, when we started this documentary, we had no clue that we were going to get the number of people involved in the movie in this documentary. So the initial thing that it was supposed to be about was really just looking at fan stories and how fans were affected by Back to the Future. In fact, it was supposed to be that related to just the time machine. All the stories that we originally looked at had something to do with the DeLorean time machine in one way or another. And then, you know, as it got bigger, we just expanded the vision of what we were doing. But it's going to be even Michael J. Fox, I didn't ask him 100,000 questions about, you know, oh, so how was it when you filmed the hoverboards and then when you jumped from the trains? And then, you know, we asked him some of that, and people certainly want to hear it. But we asked him, you know, what's it like when there's an outpouring of fans who raise money for your foundation, you mm-hmm. know, to cure Parkinson's? And to get his take on that. And that's really what the documentary is.
It's a pretty iconic series of movies.
Sure is.
Don't you think? Were you?
Sorry, I was.
JJ was crying for a second.
I was weeping.
When I worked on the Universal lot, it was like one of the fun things to do is to go to that back lot and see the courthouse, and it's, I don't know.
Did you get to visit the Universal lot and do any interviews on the lot?
We did visit it. We went. What we did is there's actually two Back to the Future documentaries on Kickstarter right now. They will both still be active when this comes out. We are back in time. The other one is called Out of Time, so that it could be as confusing as possible to everyone.
Oh, sure. Very nice.
And their documentary focuses specifically on the restoration of the DeLorean from Back to the Future Part 1, the Hero A car. Mm-hmm. You talk about the back lot. That car had sat on the back lot for years and just got destroyed. The weather, the elements, and then people just literally picking parts off the car. It was in really bad shape. Mm. And in the last, I believe it was 3 years ago, they started restoring it, and it is now on permanent display indoors at Universal Studios, fairly close to the back lot, actually, in like the NBC Universal Experience, I think it's called.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The store, yeah.
And you can go in there. There's an exhibit. The car's behind glass, and it's magnificent. And they did a documentary while they were restoring it about restoring it. So we cover that story as well in our documentary. Obviously, it's not the major focus because it's their own documentary on that. But
yeah, right.
Certainly when looking at the cultural relevance, it was a big story and we wanted to touch on it. So Joel Walzer, who led that restoration, we had him and a bunch of his team members on there. So what we did as a featurette, we took Joe to the car and just walked around with him there and, kind of let him reminisce on everything they did while sort of being there on the spot. That's not where we did his primary interview, but it'll sort of mix in with it as like a B-roll-y type of walking, talking thing. And that might actually be my only appearance on camera in the documentary as well. Hmm. And then we went to the back lot. So we went from there, got in the cars and drove over to the back lot and just filmed some B-roll there. That was really the purpose of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was our first time there and, you know, we weren't on a tram ride. And ironically, we went to back to Universal Studios a few weeks later, like as tourists. You know, we bought tickets and went in and went on all the rides.
Mm-hmm. And did you guys go on the Back to the Future ride, which is not the Simpsons ride?
I was going to say we would have gone on the Back to the Future ride had we had a time machine
that existed.
But we did go. Ride. Yeah. Yeah, I know. I'd actually never been to California before this documentary started, and I think because of this documentary and other work related things, I've been to LA probably, I don't know, 20 times in the last 2 years, but
that's more than enough to come.
Congratulations.
Up. Yeah.
Well, and I especially try to go during the winter. But I had been to Florida and been on the Back to the Future ride in Florida years ago with my wife. But so I had, you know, I essentially knew it was the same thing. Yeah. You know, close your eyes and you're in the same ride. But, we did the studio tour. This is after we had gone to the studio lot for the documentary. And on the studio tour, like, yeah, they drive you by the courthouse and there's the courthouse and Back to the Future. And you don't really even get it because you need a lot of time to process where you are. There's a gazebo in the middle of Courthouse Square mm-hmm. right now. Yeah. So it's hard to get it. But when we filmed for the documentary, and it was, I mean, we were maybe there for like 20 minutes just getting a couple shots of the grass and the things around it. You were like, oh my God, like this is, we're in the middle of Courthouse Square. And because we were not locked into a tram, we were actually able to go inside and the pillars of the original courthouse are still standing inside the facade that they put in front of it. So,
oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so it's still there. If they ripped down the facade that's in front right now, it would look exactly how it looked in Back to the Future.
Oh, that's cool.
And then we went on to the roof. So, yeah. So we climbed up the courthouse, and we went onto the roof of the courthouse, and
there's electrocuted by lightning.
Fortunately, we did not. But there was we were filming just behind the scenes stuff for our documentary that day, and like there's a piece you could, you know, it's online in our behind the scenes stuff, and it was just, it was like a take your breath away moment. Like I'm standing on the roof of the courthouse where Doc Brown, you know, fell off the ledge and the thing. I mean, wow. It was like, wow, this is one of those never would have thought this was going to happen moments. And while we were there, they were actually filming Agent Carter like 100 feet away from us.
Oh.
So we were like, wow, this is where they make movies. You know?
Yeah, I'm still baffled and kind of starstruck whenever I go onto a back lot and I'm like, okay, you know, like a Warner Brothers, their kind of common area is where they shot Dukes of Hazzard, you know, on TV shows and just all kinds of different things have been there. And I don't know, it's kind of, I like
Tinseltown.
Yeah, I like history, and it's like history in the making right there.
Well, so. And JJ and I went on a little Back to the Future tour. We visited Doc Brown's house and the Burger King. Yeah. In Burbank.
Yep.
Yeah, we went to the Gamble House in Pasadena, and it was just like, oh, okay, this looks really familiar.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty cool.
The Burger King looks like a Burger King, I gotta
right.
say.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
There's nothing futuristic about it.
Nope. It's still in 1985.
Mm. Well, we touched base a little bit about the Kickstarter campaign, and a lot of the listeners that listen to our podcast, they may be making short films or whatever kind of creative thing that they're doing. Do you have any advice in making a Kickstarter campaign? What kind of people to reach out to for press, things like that?
Yeah, I mean, people have asked me this, just not even related to film, but just, you know, oh, I want to come out with a clothing line. Like, should I put it on Kickstarter? And I think it's sort of anti-artistic, because obviously one of the great things about art is, you know, just do it. I mean, if it's your own artistic expression, put it out there and
sure,
and do it. The problem is with Kickstarter, one thing you have to keep in mind is people have to be interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the bottom line is, if I'm not interested in something, I'm not going to give my money to it.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that your project might not be good. You know, there are things that I might watch on Netflix, for example, because I'm not paying for it. You know, I pay, you know, the $8 a month for Netflix, and then I could watch whatever I want for free. So something might be interesting then, and then I might say, all right, I'll give it a look. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't necessarily throw my money at it. So one of the really cool things about this documentary that we knew early on is we were able to say, this is something that I would want to watch. You know, if I want to see it, then I'm assuming there are others out there like me who want to see it too. And I'm not one of these like crazy film guys who, you know, has seen every movie 16 times and read every script and studies. You know, I love film history. I think it's cool, but I'm more like, yeah, I want to see Transformers 9, right. You know, that's like more right up my alley. You know, I love these terrible action movies that they spend $300 million to make and they blow everything up and there's no plot. I love that stuff. So I am the Joe idiot that they market films for. And that's why when we did this documentary and I knew that I would love to see it, there had to be other people out there who would want to see it too. So I think that's one thing that you just have to keep in mind, that, you know, ask 5 of your friends and make sure they'd want to see it too. Mm-hmm. And make sure they're not just really good friends who are lying.
Right.
And then as far as press and getting it out there, that's the other thing too, because I think when Kickstarter first started, you know, I thought it was this Field of Dreams type of thing where, you know, if you build it, then everyone will donate,
yeah.
You know, and you just put up a project and then money starts coming in.
If it were that easy, that would be nice.
Yeah, right? And you'd think it was by visiting Kickstarter's site, because obviously they're, you know, you go on there and they're promoting all these projects that have raised tons of money, you know, but dig a little bit, take 5 minutes and you'll see all the projects that haven't. And like I said, Kickstarter keeps projects up forever.
Yeah.
So, you know, whatever you do will be there for all of time. And it's, you know, it's a difficult proposition in terms of getting press. I mean, the first time that we did our Kickstarter, it's not like we knew where to turn, but, you know, once you strike that right chord and people get a hold of it, it starts to get out there. You know, certainly if you know somebody that works in media, I mean, reach out to them, you know, use whatever contacts that you have. And that's, I think that's what Kickstarter is all about too. We didn't want to ask friends and family for money when we did our first Kickstarter, because I said, then we're cheating.
Yeah.
If the idea is that the world wants to see it, then let's make sure the world wants to see it.
Right.
And that's not to say that we didn't have friends and family that gave us money. We did. And it was a very small portion of what we raised. But it's not because we asked. It's because they were interested in it. Or maybe they weren't and they just wanted to support us.
Which is also possible. Stop talking about it here.
Right. Exactly. So that's what, you know, that's what you have to do. Just put it out there and you know, if you have to, ask friends and family. You know, maybe you need $25,000 to do something and the world is $15,000 interested. Well, you know, call your rich Uncle Joe and tell him you need a couple bucks. So I think that's what Kickstarter is all about. You know, it's weird because I think some of it's intangible, but I could look at a Kickstarter project and tell you right away if it's going to fail or if it's going to do well. There's just...
Oh, really?
There are intangibles about it. The one thing that definitely snuck by me, though, was Exploding Kittens. Because... And if you don't know what Exploding Kittens is, just Google it. Actually, I don't know the person, but a friend of mine is friends with one of the three Exploding Kittens guys.
Exploding Kittens?
Go to Kickstarter and look up Exploding Kittens.
I'm just pulling this up. Exploding Kittens.
All right, while we're looking it up, why don't you let us know what we can expect to find?
Yes, so you don't need to look much further than how many backers and how much money it raised. They raised $8.7 million.
What?
For animal
cruelty? And they have 219,000 and change backers.
Wow.
And it's a card game.
Yeah.
Huh.
In fact... It's a dumb card game. The way they describe it is it's the card version of Russian roulette, where you get cards and they do all these different things, but if you pick up the exploding kitten, you die and you're out of the game, unless you have a card that diffuses the exploding kitten. And if you would have just watched this video, you were going, I need to get some of the weed that they're smoking, A, and B, this project is not going to make a dollar. Well, not only did they make a dollar, they made 8.7 million of them. You know, selling this game for $20 at a time, although they got the idea very early on that they should make a not suitable for work version of the game.
Mm.
Which, by the way, why would the other version be suitable for work? I mean, I don't know what you do at work, but I don't play Exploding Kittens.
Wait, they were only looking for $10,000?
I mean, they're making a card game. How much can it cost?
True.
About 10,000.
Good point. Yeah.
219,382
well, you know,
backers.
There was also that other Kickstarter campaign about the guy that's just trying to like get potato enough ingredients salad. To make potato salad. And his goal was like $10, and he ended up getting like $100,000 or something like that.
We need to make some
sometimes,
potato salad.
So he made like potato salads.
I guess with the internet, you can never really explain like viral.
Right.
But some things just make sense. I mean, I've backed, you know, according to Kickstarter, it says I've backed 15 projects. And a lot of them are technology stuff. Like I love new gadgets on Kickstarter. And that's the easiest where you could just look at it and go, why would anybody want this? Or that is awesome. And the things that you could say that are awesome usually get funded.
Right. Right. What do you have like three things that you look at and go, oh, that'll get funded?
Yeah, like or? What boxes need to be checked?
So first of all, you have to, I mean, the number one box is does this even make any sense? Would I want this? And depending on what category it is, you know, Exploding Kittens, you know, is this cool? I don't know. And a lot of things on Kickstarter, Kickstarter appeals to geek culture. So there's a ton of, like games, you know, board games and stuff like that. And that stuff makes hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars. So that's clearly just who's sort of on Kickstarter. But especially with gadgets, it's like, does this answer a real problem? Is it affordable? Do the numbers make sense? Sometimes a campaign that might have been good kills itself because they don't know how to structure their rewards. And we went through that the first time a little bit. You know, if you look at that other documentary that I was talking about, the Out of Time, you know, their reward structure is a little bit different than ours, and they've done a great job. You know, they actually, and this is sort of a funny story, we launched on the same day. They launched at about midnight Monday morning, and then we launched, you know, 16 or 17 hours later. They had almost raised their goal by the time that we launched. Wow. And the reason is, and it's very obvious, they had this amazing reward, which was an actual piece of the time machine.
Damn.
Yeah. So they saved, you know, wires and pieces of carpet and foam and whatever else, stuff that they had taken off the time machine. Mm-hmm. And they're putting it on a little plaque and you get it. And they, that was a $200 reward. They released 20 of them. Now, I saw the project at like 8 a.m. on the East Coast. I don't know how many hours old it was, six, seven, something like that. Mm-hmm. And they were gone. The 20 of them were gone. So that's $4,000. Well, they went back into the well and they found more stuff that they had taken off the time machine. And they made that a new reward and they didn't put a limit on it. So it's still open and it's still unlimited. Wow. And they have 100 backers on that now, plus the 20.
Damn.
So they've raised $24,000 just on that.
Scrapping a car.
Yeah. And then, exactly. And then they have a co-producer credit that they sold for $4,000 and a producer credit that was $5,000 and associate producer credit. They've sold three of those, and each of those come with that, you know, fun. You get that plaque with the DeLorean parts and stuff like that. So right there, I mean, there's your money. That's you know, that's like 35 of the $50,000 that they've raised, and they have 387 backers. Now, we are ahead of them financially. We have about $70,000 right now, but we have almost 1,200 backers. So we have four times as many backers and not four times as much money.
Right.
Right.
Did you know ahead of time that that was happening, that they were going to be releasing that? And
so ironically, since the Back to the Future community, I have realized, is minuscule and everybody knows everybody, I was on a call with Joe Walzer, who is a big part of our documentary and an epically huge part of theirs. Mm-hmm. Because he, I mean, he's listed as a producer on their documentary, and he was the one that led the team that restored the car. So even though it's not his film, I mean, he's, you know, as big as you can get there without being the guy doing
sure.
it. And we were on the phone talking about something, and Joe and I talk all the time, and whenever we get on the phone, it's like a minimum of an hour. And we were about to hang up the phone, and he said, "So is there anything else going on?" I said, "Oh, you know, I totally forgot to tell you, we're launching our Kickstarter on Monday. Do me a favor, just go ahead and post about it on your Facebook group and whatever, and you know, let people know." And there was like a moment of dead silence of horror. And he's like, Steve was actually going to launch the restoration documentary on Monday.
Oh boy.
And I was like, Houston, we have a problem. And, you know, we ended up, it was all nice. There was no like, "You bastards," you know. We all ended up on a conference call and we said, "How do we fix this impossible situation?" Because our documentary is slated to release in October. We both kind of had a thought, well, maybe you should wait. And then we thought maybe you should wait, you know, to kind of spread it out. And, you know, he rightfully so. He knew that we had press ready and we've been out there. I mean, we were funded ready on Kickstarter almost 2 years ago. So people know about our documentary, and he was afraid if we would do a Kickstarter and he would wait to do his, that ours would blow up in popularity. And then he would go launch it, and it would be like, "Oh, yeah, another, you know, Back to the Future documentary, whatever." And at the same time, we were in a position where we have a lot of sort of, you know, our team is much bigger. We're working with more people. And we had done our, like, initial press blitz. Our press knew. This was, like, Thursday night. Our press knew that it was coming out Monday. We'd already reached out to. We said, "We literally can't delay this." So in the end, we both said, "All right, there's nothing we can do. This is an impossible situation. We're both just going to release it on Monday." Then we had a little legal thing with a release, and we were going to release it essentially at the same time. We didn't. Essentially, we were handcuffed until we released it, which was about 8 p.m. on the East Coast. And when, like I said, he had basically made his goal already.
Right.
And then we were like panicking. We're like, "Oh my God, like he took all the Back to the Future thunder, you know?"
Right.
There's going to be nothing. Yeah, there's going to be nothing left for us. Like, the well will be dry. And it's funny, we had spoken to Bob Gale over the weekend, just kind of saying, "What do we do? What do we do?" And Bob's like, "Listen, don't worry. Back to the Future is a big franchise. You'll both be fine." And, you know, it sounds great. That's right. But, yeah, I mean, it's funny because he wrote me an email a few days into it when we had both made our funding goal. And he's like, "I told you, you know." And he was right. And you know, I think it was like by the third day we had eclipsed his backer count. And then by the fourth day we had eclipsed how much money he made. And I mean, a lot of it is press. I mean, he's not really getting the press that we are. And I can't explain it exactly, because like I said, some of it we know. I mean, we had a strategy and we know how we, you know, got after it. And, you know, we knew about the Variety article, but a lot of, you know, like you guys, for example, you know, you just contacted me. Yeah. It's not like I sent you an email saying, hey, early call time.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're doing Anthony Cumia's show on Thursday, cool. Which is big. Yeah. I mean, for, you know, being a New Yorker, obviously Opie and Anthony were on New York radio, forever before they started doing their own things on satellite. So it's just like, wow. And, we're doing a CNBC show in a few weeks.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Yeah.
But it's, we like, got you this? First, damn it.
You did. And I've only done one other podcast, by the way, and yours is coming out like 2.5 weeks before his. So
perfect. Boom.
You nailed it.
There you go.
I had a coworker, he emailed me your link and he's like, have you taken a look at this yet? I'm like, no, I had no idea. And I put money towards the project. And I was like, I have to get this guy for the podcast. This would be great. And you emailed me like almost, I don't know, probably an hour after I emailed you. I was like, wow, this is kind of amazing.
It's well, he felt like he owed you one because you got one of the Spanish subtitled.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, for those, the guys who get the Spanish subtitles, they get my earliest attention. The other interesting thing about Kickstarter is once you do one campaign, you learn a lot. And, you know, this will be in the behind the scenes of making this documentary. But I tore my ACL playing baseball. And I'm sorry. I had to have... Yeah, it was unfortunate. And what happened is it was right around the time that we were going to do the first Kickstarter. And I actually tore my ACL the day before we filmed at the Shays house to shoot the first Kickstarter.
Jeez.
And I didn't know that it was torn. I mean, I knew that, like, ow.
Yeah.
And I had to drive up to Massachusetts with a torn ACL.
Was it your driving foot?
It absolutely was my driving foot.
Of course.
And now work, because, you know, at the time I was the director and the crew and the camera guy and the interviewer, you know. Like, I did this with a guy by the name of Greg Lassick, who was my only other tech person. And then I went up with two other people, one who is our executive producer, Louis Krubich, and Jordan, who's been somebody I've always kind of banged heads with film about, who's been a consultant on this film. So I was working through the day in like the worst possible pain you can imagine, not even knowing that, oh, I had a torn ACL. And like, I didn't want to say anything because it was such a cool, amazing day. It was such good vibes that I didn't want to ruin it being like the hypochondriac. But, you know, I found out later that week that I wasn't actually a hypochondriac. I was really just in pain.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so I had to have surgery on it. And, a lot of it was timing out my surgery to my work schedule.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then figuring out, all right, when are we going to launch this? So I looked at the calendar and about where we were in terms of the edit process. And I said, guys, I have an idea. We're going to launch this the day after my surgery because I'm going to be in bed for probably 2 weeks. So it'll give me a lot of time to focus on it. I'm already not going to be doing anything else. Sure. I'm going to be in the house. I'll be able to answer all the emails. It'll be great. Well, I went in for surgery and the doctor screwed up my surgery.
Oh,
no.
He cut through like two nerves. Oh. So what ended up happening is I was bedridden for close to 3 months.
Oh.
And by 24 hours after the surgery, I was taking 12 morphine pills a day, which, I mean, sounds like a great time.
But I promise it wasn't, you that it is.
Yeah. But it wasn't even helping me because I had nerve damage. I mean, it was terrible, but now literally I'm managing this Kickstarter campaign from bed. And that was like all I was doing. And I knew how time consuming that it was and how many emails come in and requests and stuff like that and trying to keep up with the press and follow it and see what's going on. And so when we did this campaign, luckily there was no surgery involved, but I knew that, all right, you better kind of be geared up to deal with this because there's a lot going on. And we happen to have a ton else going on just in terms of other, you know, corporate work that we have. So I never realized how big this campaign would be. You know, in your head, you just equate it to the last one.
Right.
This one is, in terms of just popularity and stuff, has been, you know, five times as big. And now I'm kind of not sleeping much.
Well, there are drawbacks, but
yeah, it comes with the territory.
Yeah. When do you guys premiere for the film?
October 21st.
Okay. And now
that makes sense.
Is it, Is it October? Is that the day that?
That is future day. That's the day they go.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
Yeah.
Will you buy yourself a DeLorean with the proceeds, or have you decided that that's just not a wise purchase?
That would be quite frivolous.
Yeah. Considering it's a pretty crappy car from what I hear.
Yeah, I would like to. I don't know if my wife would let me.
Yeah, hold your tongue.
You know, it's, you know, when we were having dreams of grandeur for the first campaign, I said, listen, we're going to put this thing on Kickstarter. We're going to make like 150 grand. And what we should do is we should buy a DeLorean and restore it as part of the narrative of the documentary, which was the most self-serving, you know. Oh, and when we're done, I'll just hang on to that.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly. You guys can rent it from me if you'd like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So good thing we didn't raise that much money.
Grand,
yeah. Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Is the premiere going to be out here in Los Angeles? Or
it is.
Okay.
So they did this great thing for the 25th anniversary called We're Going Back, where they had like a week's worth of festivities and you know, they had actual hoverboarding where you could get, you know, strapped into cables and ride a hoverboard.
Nice.
And they had an Enchantment Under the Sea dance and all these other fun Back to the Future related things. They went out to where the train tracks were, where the car got destroyed in part three, and reenacted that and all this fun stuff for the super fans. And they're doing it again for the 30th anniversary. It's still called We're Going Back. They're going to start selling tickets soon. I don't believe they've publicized what events they're doing, so I have to zip it on that.
Yeah.
But one of the events will be the premiere of our documentary.
Sweet.
Which, as we're looking right now, will be on the Universal backlot on future day. So, I mean, talk
so
about
cool.
Yeah, talk about like
we're all available.
It would be great if they just took over the Simpsons ride and just played it so everyone's just in a DeLorean watching the movie.
Watching the movie from the ride.
That's not a bad way to do it. Although I'd probably get seasick sitting in that thing for an hour and a half.
True.
Well, you know, just take out the motion control, so, you know, you're not like, I've said too much. I've already put too much thought into this.
Well, I've signed up for the We're Going Back newsletter. And so hopefully I'm able to get tickets.
Yeah, I got to tell you, some of the stuff that I know they're doing is going to be ridiculous. Just like once in a lifetime type stuff that if you like Back to the Future, I mean, I don't even have to sell you on it. When they announce it, you're gonna be like, yeah, going to that.
Yeah.
You know,
we'll be in attendance.
Yeah, they've done them in the past, and I wanted to go last year. I think it was last year. The fact that it's going to be the 30th anniversary, it's like, why not, you know?
Well, you know, JJ, I've already spoken to Jason, and he said that us three are going to be his plus three for the event, right,
oh,
Jason?
That's nice.
Look at that. Yeah, why not? You know, what's funny is we sold tickets to the premiere in our first Kickstarter, and we had this connection with We're Going Back. It's not like we, you know, that was something that was on the table from day one. We had spoken to them. It was one of those great yeses that we got very early on when we were just, you know, three guys making a movie.
Sure.
But we had no clue like what the premiere would be. So it's funny because we sold these tickets and people bought them, and we were like, great, we just got $250 for a pair of tickets to, I don't know, you know. it's going to be in the parking lot at JCPenney.
Yeah.
How apropos.
Sweet.
And we're going to watch the film on my iPhone. Everybody huddle around.
We're going to Jason's house in Queens.
Yeah, exactly.
Bring some toilet paper roll so we could amplify the sound better.
Yeah. And it's bring your own food, guys, you know, so.
But
now it's a very real thing, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, even though they said they were doing the 30th anniversary, you know, there were a lot of details they had to work out on their end. You know, even a couple months ago, it was kind of, you know, they weren't exactly sure how things were going to shake out either. So, you know, we were sort of hanging on them too. But before we launched this Kickstarter, everything was set in stone, so it was good.
Awesome.
That's wonderful.
So for anyone who's listening and wants to buy tickets to the premiere, it's real now.
it's a thing.
You get two tickets to something for $250.
Yeah, it's an actual event, yes.
Well, Jason, thank you for being on the show. Do you have any lasting advice you can give to anybody that is trying to get into the industry, if it means getting on Kickstarter and making your own film, or
being friends with Michael J. Fox?
It doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
I think for me, and this, I don't know if it works for everybody, but it certainly worked for me. You know, a lot of people take the path, and I'm sure you guys have talked about this on the show, where all right, I'm going to start out in the lunchroom and I'm going to deliver cups because that's how you have to work your way up. And then, you know, maybe in 5 years I'll be actually cooking the food that the people eat on set. And then maybe in 20 years, you know, I'll get to, you know, set up a light. And that was probably the way that you got into Hollywood years ago. But I never did that, you know? I felt like I had an eye for it. I had a talent for it. I spent as much time on Google University as possible, just learning everything that I could possibly learn. And I just started making films. You know, it costs nothing today. You can go to Best Buy and buy a camera and put something out, and it could be perfect. You know, I spoke earlier about Legends of the Night, which is on Netflix now. If you guys want to watch it, that's the Batman documentary I was talking about. It was shot on a Canon Rebel, half of it with a kit lens.
Wow.
And by one person, and it looks phenomenal, and he did a great job on it. So it's not, you know, and we've spent so much time on the set of the Goldbergs because of Adam, and you know, been on the Sony lot. They did a hoverboard episode and we filmed that as B-roll for our film.
Yes, they did. That was an awesome episode.
Yeah, that was awesome.
And by the way, that will be one of the rewards. It will be a signed script from the hoverboard episode.
So cool.
Sweet.
In fact, not only the signed shooting script, but the signed original draft, which nobody would even know about because it wasn't filmed.
Yeah. it never is.
It never, you know, so seeing how they do things in Hollywood, I remember the day that they shot the actual hoverboard scenes with Adam and his sister outside. That was an offsite shoot. And there was literally a guy there whose job was to make sure they had the suntan lotion for everybody.
That's a good
job. Like, that's good.
I was like, this is a job. Like, that's, you know, the way we were. And I know New York and LA are a little different, but, you know, we have such a great group in New York with Malka Media where, you know, I mean, yes, everybody sort of has a role. I mean, you can't exist otherwise. It's anarchy. But from one shoot to the next, I mean, there are shoots where there are guys I won't direct necessarily. You know, I might not even have a technical job on set. And somebody who's been doing this for a year or two is the director of that shoot. You know, there's no necessary, first of all, there's no, like, you know, pissing contest. Like, oh, I've been doing this longer and I'm the best. And I did a Back to the Future documentary.
Right.
You know, it's more that just different people step into different roles and you use your abilities and you just do it. And, you know, I'm living proof that you can just go film for a day and put something on Kickstarter. And next thing you know, you're shooting, you know, $130,000 budget documentary that has the complete world's attention.
That's crazy.
That's true. Yeah. Well, thank you again for being on the show, Jason.
Yeah, Jason, it's been awesome. A pleasure.
Next time you're in LA, come by the house. We can hang out.
Why not? Yeah. I will. I'll be there.
Sweet.
Next month.
Awesome.
We'll hang out with you and Adam Goldberg.
Yeah, we'll see you in October, right? We're going to be your plus three. You already promised me.
Yeah.
You guys are invited.
Sweet. Thanks, man.
Nailed it, guys. We really suckered him in that one.
You're like, shit, recording? An hour and 7 minutes just to get him to invite us to the damn thing.
I've never even seen this movie. What is he talking about?
I think
about?
It was time well invested.
Yeah.
Back in the future? What's it?
Yeah,
they made three of these?
well, listeners out there, if you want to get a hold of us, ask us any questions or have any concerns or maybe even maybe pass along a question over to Jason, email us at earlycalltime@gmail.com. You can also give us a call at 267-225-CHAT.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you guys want
to say?
We're
on Instagram,
yeah.
Facebook,
also,
Twitter.
Also, you know, the Back to the Future campaign is not done yet, so go onto there and give Jason your money.
Jason needs your money.
Please, I got
to
eat.
Bitcoin. Send him Bitcoin.
What do they Google for? Because if they do Back to the Future documentary Kickstarter, they might take him to the other documentary.
Yeah, don't. I mean, listen, you could donate to those guys too. You know, if you have a lot of money, just hook everybody up. But if you go on Kickstarter, just search for Back in Time. Although, as I'm screenshotting it right now, if you, like right on the homepage, we're like the number one thing under what's popular, which is kind of cool.
Nice.
Oh man.
Yeah.
I think that's because you're on our podcast right now.
I think that's what happened because I wasn't heard. I wasn't before, and now I am.
This one guy in Tarzana was like, oh.
We're trending. It's not a big deal.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it is. I think that's been the craziest thing about this whole process is just seeing where this thing has landed. Literally right now, if you click on what's popular, I mean, we're the number one film on Kickstarter.
That's awesome.
It's insane.
Congratulations. Yes.
To everyone, all of us. We've all done a good thing here today.
Pop some bubbly for you, Jason.
You guys did it. You're my new PR firm.
Yes.
Sick.
I thought we were just getting plus three. We're getting
He's
going to
regret that so hard.
And that's a wrap. Didn't get your fill at Craft Services and you want more? Check out earlycalltime.com for more podcasts and information pertaining to the ever-growing entertainment industry. And remember to tell your friends about us via Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.